and in all the media publications analyzed here, the details of his seizure, the disposition of his body, and the nature of his wounds were recounted extensively and with barely concealed relish. These details were also repeated at every opportunity, and most notably at the trial. The finding of the bodies of the four women, by contrast, was a back-page item in the Times, and in all four of the media institutions in our sample, the accounts of the violence done to the four murdered women were very succinct, omitted many details, and were not repeated after the initial disclosures. No attempt was made to reconstruct the scene with its agony and brutal violence, so that the drama conveyed in the accounts of Popiełuszko's murder was entirely missing. The murder of the four churchwomen was made remote and impersonal. The Time account, for example, after giving the names of the victims, says, two of the women had been raped before being shot in the back of the head. The New York Times account is also quite succinct. The Rogers Commission report pointed out that one of the victims had been shot through the back of the head with the weapon that left exit wounds that destroyed her face. The Rogers report also noted that those present at the disinterment found extensive wounds and that the bodies were also bruised. Raymond Bonner's account in Weakness and Deceit noted that in the crude grave stacked on top of each other were the bodies of four women. The first hauled out of the hole was Jean Donovan, 27 years old, a lay missionary from Cleveland. Her face had been blown away by a high-caliber bullet that had been fired into the back of her head. Her pants were unzipped, her underwear twisted around her ankles. When area peasants found her, she was nude from the waist down. They had tried to replace the garments before burial. Then came Dorothy Kazel, a 40-year-old Ursuline nun also from Cleveland. At the bottom of the pit were Mary Knoll nuns Edith Ford, 40, and Maura Clark, 49, both from New York. All the women had been executed at close range. The peasants who found the women said that one had her underpants stuffed in her mouth, another's had been tied over her eyes. All had been raped. We may note that the failure of Time and the New York Times to mention the bruises, which both of these publications mentioned and repeated as regards Popiełuszko, the failure to mention the destruction of Jean Donovan's face, the suppression of the degrading and degraded use of the nun's underwear, the failure to give the account of the peasants who found the bodies. These and other details given by Bonner and suppressed by Time and the New York Times, and also Newsweek and CBS News, add emotional force and poignancy to the scene. Such details are included for a Popiełuszko, but not for four American women murdered by a U.S. client state. The Rogers report also pointed out that the forensic surgeons sent to the scene of the crime by the junta, at the urging of Ambassador Robert White, refused to perform an autopsy on the ground that no surgical masks were available. This touch, which would have cast the junta and its agents in a bad light, was also omitted from U.S. media accounts. In the Popiełuszko case, both the finding of the body and the trial were occasions for an aggressive portrayal of the details of the act of murder and the condition of the body. The mass media reticence on such matters at the time of the finding of the bodies of the four women was exceeded by their restraint at the trial. Lydia Chavez of the New York Times, who attended the trial, notes that there were 8 hours of testimony and 7 hours of argument that focused on the women's work in El Salvador and on the details of their kidnappings and deaths. But her article gave no details whatsoever on the medical evidence. 2.4.2. Lack of indignation and insistent demands for justice. In the Popiełuszko case, the press conveyed the impression of intolerable outrage that demanded immediate rectification. In the case of the murder of the four American women, while the media asserted and quoted government officials that this was a brutal and terrible act, it was not declared intolerable, and the media did not insist on or quote people who demanded justice. The media relied heavily on senior officials of the U.S. and Salvadoran governments who expressed a more resigned view of the situation and were prepared to allow the Salvadoran system of justice to work things out. Correspondingly, the media also moved into a philosophical vein. The women, as Time points out, were victims of the mindless increasing violence of El Salvador, December 15, 1980. With Popiełuszko, It was live government officials who committed the crime, not blind forces that are hard to bring to book. Even the funeral and memorial services for the women in the United States were not allowed to serve as an occasion for outrage and a demand for justice. For the most part, they were ignored and suppressed. The New York Times, December 8, 1981, gave a tiny backpage UPI account of the memorial service for Sister Dorothy Cazell, featuring the apolitical statement by Bishop Anthony M. Pila that the life of a missionary has never been easy or glamorous. We must consider, too, that as Ambassador Kirkpatrick indicated, the victims may have been asking for it. As Newsweek observed, December 15, 1980, the violence in El Salvador is likely to focus with increasing ferocity on the Roman Catholic Church. Many priests and nuns advocate reform, and some of them are militant leftists. Such sentiments mean trouble, even for more moderate members of the clergy. Note here also the impersonality of the violence. Nowhere in the article is there a suggestion that the U.S.-backed government initiated and was doing the bulk of the murdering. In the case of Pope Yawushko, by contrast, the media never once suggested that he was a regrettable victim of escalating conflict between the state and rebellious forces, or between East and West. That situation was much simpler than the one in El Salvador. Pope Yawushko was murdered by officials of the state, and this was intolerable. The complexities and resort to philosophical inanities about unallocable violence are reserved for deaths in the provinces. 2.4.3. The lack of zeal in the search for villainy at the top. As we saw earlier, in the Pope Yawushko case, the mass media eagerly, aggressively, and on a daily basis sought and pointed to evidence of top-level involvement in the killing. In the case of the killings of the four women, we can observe a completely different approach. Here the media found it extremely difficult to locate Salvadoran government involvement in the murders, even with evidence staring them in the face. Their investigatory zeal was modest, and they were happy to follow the leads of Trust Me Duarte and U.S. officials as the case unfolded. They played dumb. The Salvadoran army and security forces had been killing Salvadorans in the same way they had killed the four women, for months. What is more, the churches with which the women were connected had been recently threatened by the army. More direct evidence was that local peasants had been forced to bury the bodies by the local military, but the media did not use this information to help them find the locus of the murders. The initial line of the U.S. and Salvadoran governments was that there was no proof of military involvement, although the military's concealment of the bodies was not proper. A statement issued by the junta on December 8th claimed that the murders were terrorists of the extreme right, and Duarte reiterated this view to the press, which passed it along. In keeping with the government line, 20 days after the murders, the New York Times still spoke of unidentified assailants, although the leads to the National Guard were already plentiful, and it repeated the Rogers Report finding that the security forces may have tried to conceal the deaths after the bodies had been found. Gradually, so much evidence seeped out to show that the women had been murdered by members of the National Guard that the involvement of government forces could no longer be evaded. A two-part process of damage limitation ensued, expounded by Salvadoran and U.S. officials and faithfully reflected in the media. One was a distinction between the government and the National Guard. In the Pope Yawushko case, the reader was never allowed to forget that the murdering police were part of the Polish government. In the case of the four American women, it was barely evident in the mass media that the killers had any connection with the Salvadoran government. This was in keeping with the basic myth, also consistently followed by the media, that the Salvadoran government was reformist and centrist, trying to control killings by extremists of the right and left. This fabrication allowed a two-track system of massive killing by the army and its affiliates, and simultaneous claims of regret by the reformers unable to control the extremists. This was reminiscent of the heyday of mass murder in Argentina, when the New York Times regularly portrayed the junta and people like the recently convicted General Videla as moderates unable to control the right-wing extremists who were killing people. The most important goal of the immediate damage containment process was to stifle any serious investigation of the responsibility of the officials of the Salvadoran government. The Salvadoran strategy was foot-dragging from beginning to end, as the idea of convicting soldiers for killing anybody was contrary to Salvadoran practice, and moreover, there is little doubt that the responsibility for the crime went high. The U.S. official strategy, once it was clear that the National Guard was responsible for the killing, was to get the low-level killers tried and convicted, necessary to vindicate the system of justice in El Salvador, at least to the extent of keeping the dollars flowing from Congress, while protecting the reformers at the top. On September 30, 1981, Ambassador Dean Hinton stated with assurance that the local National Guardsmen were acting on their own, although internal State Department documents of the time recognized that the Salvadoran investigation had been a joke, and other evidence existed suggesting top-level involvement. Nonetheless, the official position was clear. To go along with the official line, the mass media had to stop investigating high-level involvement and even to suppress evidence emerging from other sources. And so they proceeded to do this. After a two-month investigation of the murders, the reporter John Dinkes filed a story through Pacific News Service that showed the murders to have been pre-planned in some detail. First, there were intercepted radio communications indicating military discussions of the arrival of the women at the airport and other evidence of close surveillance of their flight plans, all suggesting a coordinated and extensive military operation. Second, a former deputy minister of planning described to Dinkes a half-hour presentation by Salvadoran Defense Minister Guillermo Garcia in the National Palace, denouncing the nuns and priests in the very area of the murders and stating that something must be done, only 2 weeks prior to the murders. In a remarkable feat of self-censorship, most of the mass media completely ignored the Dinkes findings. Dinkes's report appeared in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and some 15 other papers, but not a word of it found its way into the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, or CBS News, and its leads were not pursued by any media. Instead, the media kept repeating the assurance of Duarte and the U.S. officials that they were satisfied that the killings did not go beyond the local National Guardsmen and that the matter would be pursued diligently through proper legal channels. In March 1984, Colonel Roberto Santivanez, a high official in Salvadoran intelligence, agreed to talk about the death squad network in El Salvador, and his claims found their way onto CBS News and the front page of the New York Times. Santivanez gave highly credible details about the murder of the four women, indicating that the act had been committed on the specific order of Colonel Oscar Edgardo Casanova, who was in charge of the zone in which the killings took place. Colonel Casanova was transferred to another assignment 2 weeks after the murder as part of the official cover-up. His first cousin Eugenio Vides Casanova, the Minister of Defense chosen by Duarte and head of the National Guard in December 1980, knew about the murder order by his cousin, as did Duarte. Although this crushing evidence implicated a high officer in the murder and the current Minister of Defense and Duarte in the cover-up, there was no follow-up to this story, no connection back to the Dinkes story of high-level discussions of the need to do something about the religious workers, no editorials, no indignation, and no pressure for action. In sum, the leads provided by Dinkes and the testimony of Santivanes strongly suggest that the killing of the women was based on a high-level decision. The evidence is even clearer that middle-level officials of the government ordered the killing, and that the highest-level officials engaged in a continuing and systematic cover-up. In the Polish case, the evidence of top-level involvement was never forthcoming. But the issue was pursued by the U.S. mass media relentlessly. In the case of the four churchwomen, where the evidence of top-level involvement was abundant, the U.S. mass media failed to press the matter, or even to engage in the pursuit of obvious investigative leads. We cannot describe here the full details of the failure of the Salvadoran process of justice, which never moved forward except under U.S. pressure and threats. The mass media did at one point berate the Salvadoran government for stonewalling the investigation, but the media entirely failed to capture the depth and scope of the stonewalling process, or to remark on its significance in this fledgling democracy. And they generally transmitted Salvadoran and U.S. government claims about the state of the process without sarcasm or expressions of outrage. If they had given full details, the Salvadoran government would have been thoroughly discredited. Thus, the extensive evidence concerning official Salvadoran refusals to take action or to interrogate relevant witnesses, and concerning threats to witnesses, lawyers, and judges, which would have been aired with delight if applicable to a Polish investigation, were ignored. A few illustrations of the Salvadoran proceedings will have to suffice here. 2 years after the crime, for example, the prosecutors expressed ignorance of the testimony, in the court record, of former guardsman Cesar Valier Espinosa, dated August 9, 1982, which quotes Sub-Sergeant Kalindres Aleman as stating on December 2, 1980, that there were superior orders to apprehend the women. They were also ignorant of the statement of former National Guard Sergeant Dagoberto Martinez taken by the FBI in Los Angeles, California, which establishes the existence of a cover-up of the crime as early as December 1980. A second illustration of the process: two of three judges assigned to the case resigned for fear of their lives. As we noted, Judge Ramirez, who was investigating the Romero murder, fled for the same reason. This line of evidence has cumulative weight, but it was never treated as a whole by the press and was barely mentioned as individual items of backpage news. A third illustration: according to former Ambassador Robert White, two National Guardsmen who might have been able to link higher-ranking officers to the murders of the women were killed by military death squads, then listed as missing in action. A final illustration: when the Salvadoran triggermen were finally assigned attorneys, one of the three, Salvador Antonio Ibarra, was prepared to defend the men seriously. His colleagues pressed Ibarra to abide by the statement that the possibility of a cover-up had been thoroughly investigated and rejected. He refused to go along with this request, with the consequence that on October 30, 1983, Ibarra was seized by the National Guard and tortured at its headquarters. Released only under U.S. pressure, Ibarra fled the country, leaving the way clear for a lawyer team that would accept the notion that there had been a thorough investigation of top-level involvement. This last incident alone made it into the mass media in isolated and fleeting treatment. The others and the package were not featured in the free press. The U.S. government also engaged in a systematic cover-up of both the Salvadoran cover-up and the facts of the case. The U.S. mass media, while briefly noting the Salvadoran stonewalling, failed to call attention to the equally important lies and suppressions of their own government. As we have pointed out, both the Carter and Reagan administrations put protection of its client above the quest for justice for four U.S. citizens murdered by agents of that government. The U.S. government's stonewalling to protect its client took many forms. One was an active collaboration in the Salvadoran cover-up. Former National Guard Sergeant Dagoberto Martinez was allowed to emigrate to the United States in December 1980, and although a subsequent interview by the FBI indicated that Martinez admitted knowledge of the perpetrators of the crime and a failure to report that information in violation of Salvadoran law, no action was taken against him. U.S. officials also reiterated that there was no reason to believe that higher-level officials knew about the crime or participated in it when they had clear knowledge of a cover-up and a refusal to investigate. The State Department also regularly lied about the thoroughness of the investigation. Ambassador Hinton stated in public that National Guardsman Perez Nieto was thoroughly interrogated and repeatedly denied that anyone superior to him had ordered him to watch the women. A State Department cable, however, describes Nieto's testimony as incomplete, evasive, and uncooperative. A second form of official U.S. participation in the cover-up was a refusal to make public information on the Salvadoran investigation and evidence uncovered by the United States itself. The Rogers Report was released belatedly, in a version that edited out the original report's statement about the sad state of the Salvadoran system of justice. In response to a growing chorus of criticism of the delays, Judge Harold R. Tyler was appointed by the U.S. government to carry out a further investigation. His report was kept under wraps for a long time, again apparently because it had some serious criticism of the Salvadoran judicial process that would have interfered with Reagan administration plans to claim progress every time such certification was required. The families of the victims and their attorneys regularly found the U.S. government unwilling to release information on the case. The argument given was that the information was sensitive and that releasing it would interfere with the legal process in El Salvador. As the Salvadoran process was a sick joke, moving only in response to U.S. threats, the official rationale was transparently fraudulent. Furthermore, Duarte was regularly making statements that the arrested guardsmen were surely guilty and that nobody higher than them was involved, which blatantly prejudged the case. The only plausible rationale for the U.S. cover-up is that the administration wanted to minimize adverse publicity concerning the performance of its murderous client. Information on what was really going on, or its internal analyses of the case or appraisals of the Salvadoran legal process, would make the client look bad. The administration hoped that the case would go away, but until that happened, it wanted the publicity flow to be under its control. Part of the reason the administration wanted control was to allow it to claim reasonable progress in the pursuit of the case whenever the military government was due for more money. As with other right-wing satellites, improvement is always found at money crunch time. In its July 1982 certification report, the State Department found that substantial progress had been made in the case and predicted a trial in the fall of 1982. In early 1983, the certification report noted significant developments in the case. This manipulation of evidence to protect the flow of arms and money to the regime would not be easy with full disclosure or with a critical and honest press. This cover-up of the Salvadoran judicial process, even though four murdered American women were involved, did not arouse the press to indignation or satire, nor did it cause them to provide more than minimal coverage of the inquiry. 2.4.4. The Trial. Five National Guardsmen for $19.4 million. The trial of the five immediate killers of the four women should have been presented in a Kafkaesque framework, but the U.S. media played it very straight. The trial took place 3.5 years after the acts of murder, despite the fact that the trigger men were immediately identified and despite enormous U.S. pressure. Two of three judges assigned to the case had resigned out of fear for their lives, and the only independent defense attorney had fled the country after a session of torture at National Guard headquarters. The defense at the trial made no effort to defend the men on the grounds of orders from above, although this is a standard defense in such cases, and significant evidence was available for use in this instance. The mass media failed to note the point, although it suggests fear, a deal, or both, and although, as we saw in the Popiewuszko case, the media are sometimes immensely alert to cover-ups. In March 1984, former intelligence officer Santibanez stated that the guardsmen knew that if they don't name Casanova, they will get out of jail as soon as it is feasible. This testimony was not referred to in the trial context. The media played dumb. Like the Salvadoran elections of 1982 and 1984, this trial was thoroughly American in staging and motivation. As Anna Kerrigan put it, security in the courtroom was in the hands of a special judicial protection unit, formed and trained in Glencoe, Alabama. The jurors were driven to the courtroom in the morning and returned to their homes after the verdict in bulletproof American embassy vehicles. Meals and camp beds were provided by the embassy so that if necessary, the jurors and the staff of the court could sleep overnight within the protection of the guarded courthouse. And when the electricity failed, just as the prosecution began to make its presentation, light was restored by means of hurricane lamps delivered by embassy staff. The stakes were U.S. dollars. Congress had frozen $19.4 million pending the favorable outcome of the case. Within 24 hours of the decision, the State Department, announcing that justice had been done, released the money to the charge of Minister of Defense Vides Casanova, who had been head of the National Guard on December 4, 1980, when the murders took place, whose first cousin, according to Colonel Santibanez, had given the direct order to kill, and who had so effectively protected his cousin and stalled the prosecution of underlings for 3.5 years. In conformity with the predictions of a propaganda model, the mass media failed entirely to capture the quality of this scene. The American omnipresence, the courtroom security, the failure of the defense to press the responsibility of the higher authorities, the role of Vides Casanova, the literal money transaction for justice in this single case, which dragged on for 3.5 years. Newsweek found the result a remarkable achievement in an article entitled, "A Defeat for a Death Squad, June 4, 1984, despite the fact that it was the National Guard that killed the women." The article does stress the difficulties in bringing and winning the case, and the possibility of a cover-up of higher-level personnel, but it does not use this information to point up the nature of the system being supported by the United States. It also closes out the discussion with reference to the Tyler Report discounting high-level involvement, without quoting the report's acknowledgement of some evidence supporting the involvement of higher-ups, or mentioning the report's admission of the limits of its information. No reference is made to Santibanez or the Dinguez report. Newsweek sticks to an official source and misreads it. 2.5. 23 religious victims in Guatemala, 1980 through 85. The modern history of Guatemala was decisively shaped by the U.S. organized invasion and overthrow of the democratically elected regime of Jacobo Arbenz in June 1954. Since that time, while Guatemala has remained securely within the U.S. sphere of influence, badly needed economic and social reforms were put off the agenda indefinitely, political democracy was stifled, and state terror was institutionalized and reached catastrophic levels in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Given the client status of Guatemala and the fact that the anti-democratic counter-revolution served important elite interests, a propaganda model suggests that its victims will be unworthy, which should be reflected in both the quantity and quality of media attention. Furthermore, whereas victimization in Soviet client states like Poland and Czechoslovakia is regularly traced back to the Soviet occupations, a propaganda model would predict that the U.S. media will not explain the contemporary Guatemalan environment of state terror as a natural product of the U.S. intervention in 1954 and thereafter. On the contrary, we would expect the United States to be portrayed as a benevolent and concerned bystander, trying its very best to curb abuses of right and left extremists. Before looking at the media's handling of Guatemala, however, let us step back for a brief review of the crucial period 1945 to 54 and its sequel to set the stage for an examination of the media's role in the 1980s. Arbenz and his predecessor, Juan Arevalo, led the first democratic system in Guatemalan history. During the decade of their rule, newspapers, social groups, unions, peasants, and political parties could organize without fear of repression or murder. But this fragile democracy rested on a base of concentrated land ownership and foreign control of land and strategic facilities that was a constant threat to its independence and political freedom, as well as a human disaster. The struggle for unionization and land reform during the democratic decade was motivated in part by a desire to build a mass constituency that would provide an institutional base for democracy. Each progressive move by both Arevalo and Arbenz was greeted with fierce hostility by the local oligarchy, the multinational corporate community, and the U.S. government. Communism was found to be in control or a threat from the time trade unions were allowed to organize in 1947, and Arbenz's modest and effective land reform was the last straw. With U.S. initiative, organization, funding, and direct psychological warfare and terror operations, a tiny mercenary army ousted Arbenz and installed an anti-communist regime. From 1954 to the present day, neither reform nor democracy, let alone radical change, has been possible in Guatemala. The main reason for this is that the forces into whose hands the United States delivered that country in 1954 bitterly opposed any change that might affect, however slightly, their entrenched position and they had learned from the 1945 through 54 lesson that democracy moves inexorably toward reform and threats to privilege in a system of extreme inequality. The very brief interludes of tentative openness after 1954 witnessed the quick emergence of protective organizations of urban workers and the peasantry, strikes and reformists, and radical parties and organizations. As Piero Gliheses puts it, in the last months of the Arana period, 1970 through 74, the repression had acquired a more selective character, and on repeated occasions, Laharoud, Arana's successor, 1974 to 78, refrained from settling strikes by force. But the feebleness of the reforms and the awakened hopes and pressures forced a further choice, and given the nature of the regime, the wave of terror that followed was the only logical choice for the Guatemalan ruling class. Another reason for the failures of both reform and democracy has been ongoing U.S. influence. The U.S. establishment found the pluralism and democracy of the years 1945 to 54 intolerable, and it eventually ended that experiment. In the succeeding 32 years of U.S. guidance, not only has Guatemala gradually become a terrorist state rarely matched in the scale of systematic murder of civilians, but its terrorist proclivities have increased markedly at strategic moments of escalated U.S. intervention. The first point was the invasion and counter-revolution of 1954, which reintroduced political murder and large-scale repression to Guatemala following the decade of democracy. The second followed the emergence of a small guerrilla movement in the early 1960s, when the United States began serious counterinsurgency, CI training of the Guatemalan army. In 1966, a further small guerrilla movement brought the Green Berets and a major CI war in which 10,000 people were killed in pursuit of 300 or 400 guerrillas. It was at this point that the death squads and disappearances made their appearance in Guatemala. The United States brought in police training in the 1970s, which was followed by the further institutionalization of violence. The solution to social problems in Guatemala, specifically attributable to the 1954 intervention and the form of U.S. assistance since that time, has been permanent state terror. With Guatemala, the United States invented the counterinsurgency state. The special role of the army in the counterinsurgency state gradually elevated its status and power, and eventually gave it the institutional capacity to rule Guatemala. As in many U.S. client states, the military used its power to carve out economic opportunities and to steal, directly or indirectly. The terrorism, thievery, and autonomy of the Guatemalan military reached a temporary peak, later surpassed by Rios Montt, during the reign of Lucas Garcia, 1978 through 82. This overlapped the brief interlude of the Carter human rights policy, during which there was open criticism of the Guatemalan government and a brief and partial cutoff of arms supply from the United States under congressional pressure. Even during the Carter years, however, relations with Guatemala were not hostile. It was as if a child in the family were naughty and briefly put in the corner. Part of the reason for the willingness of the Carter government to provide no new arms supplies was that the bad boy was in no danger. In El Salvador in 1980, by contrast, where the Carter administration saw the possibility of a left-wing victory, support was quickly forthcoming to a right-wing terror regime. During the Reagan years, the number of civilians murdered in Guatemala ran into the tens of thousands, and disappearances and mutilated bodies were a daily occurrence. Studies by Amnesty International, AI, America's Watch, AW, and other human rights monitors have documented a military machine run amok, with the indiscriminate killing of peasants, including vast numbers of women and children, the forcible relocation of hundreds of thousands of farmers and villagers into virtual concentration camps, and the enlistment of many hundreds of thousands in compulsory civil patrols. Reagan, however, visiting Guatemala in December 1982, commented that head of state Rios Montt was totally committed to democracy and was receiving a bum rap on human rights abuses. 2 months earlier, AI released its report describing 60 different Indian villages in which massacres of civilians took place in a 3-month period, with the total killed exceeding 2,500. The Reagan policy toward Guatemala was, as with South Africa, constructive engagement. From the beginning, the administration strove to embrace and provide arms to the military governments. Ongoing mass murder was merely an inconvenience. One method by which the administration sought to rehabilitate our relations with the Guatemala regimes was by continual lying about their human rights record, with Reagan himself setting the standard. Stephen Bosworth of the State Department assured a House committee in July 1981 that the Lucas Garcia government was successfully attacking the guerrillas while taking care to protect innocent bystanders. The State Department's country report on human rights for 1981 also found it impossible to determine who was doing all the killing in Guatemala, and disappearances were attributed to the right and the left, but not to the government. Amnesty International, by contrast, in February 1981, gave detailed evidence that the thousands of murders were almost entirely governmental in origin, including those of the death squads, whose victims were targeted in an annex of Guatemala's National Palace under the direct supervision of President Lucas Garcia. With the overthrow of Lucas Garcia, suddenly, as if by magic, the Reagan administration line altered, and Stephen Bosworth could not emphasize strongly enough the favorable contrast between the current human rights situation in Guatemala and the situation last December. Melvin Levitsky, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, told another congressional committee that the United States cannot easily sustain a relationship with a government which engages in violence against its own people, as with the Lucas Garcia regime. When Lucas Garcia was in power, Bosworth founded a caring regime that protected the innocent, and the State Department couldn't determine that the government was doing any killing. With Lucas Garcia ousted, the State Department discovered that he was an indiscriminate murderer and assumed a high moral tone about his behavior. That is, the State Department implicitly conceded that it was lying earlier and counted on the press not to point this out. Of course, the reason for the switch was to help make a favorable case for Lucas Garcia's successor, Rios Montt. Under Rios Montt, there was a dramatic decline in human rights abuses, according to State Department spokesman John Hughes in January 1983. Rios Montt is the one whom Reagan found to be getting a bum rap. But as we noted, Amnesty International found Rios Montt to be another top-rank murderer, who appears to have exceeded his predecessor in civilian massacres. When Rios Montt was ousted in his turn, once again the State Department line shifted. It was admitted that things had been terrible under Rios Montt in 1982, but now there was a dramatic improvement, and the government was showing increased sensitivity to human rights questions. It is evident that we have here a consistent pattern that may be formulated into a quasi-law in the case of a terrorist state with which the administration wants constructive engagement. Things are always okay and improving, but when that regime is ousted, its record deteriorates ex post facto and looks most unfavorable compared with the humanistic and sensitive one now in power. This droll pattern of identical apologetics for each successor terrorist and ex post denigration of the one ousted is an Orwellian process that the Western press associates with totalitarian states, but it happens here, and it can only occur if the mass media are cooperative. They must be willing to downplay or ignore the large-scale murders going on in Guatemala in the first place. In that context, the serial apologetics, the lies defending each murderer, and the mind-boggling hypocrisy will hardly be newsworthy. Given the U.S. role in originating and sustaining the Guatemalan counterinsurgency state, and the fact that that state is dedicated to blocking the growth of popular organizations, that is, anti-communist in Orwellian rhetoric, and has a strong U.S. business presence, a propaganda model would anticipate a lack of media interest in its unworthy victims and an evasion of the U.S. role in its evolution and practices. We would expect reports on Guatemala put out by Amnesty International and other human rights groups to be downplayed or ignored, despite their spectacular data and horrifying stories. This is a strong test of the model, as the number of civilians murdered between 1978 and 1985 may have approached 100,000, with the style of killing reminiscent of Pol Pot. As AI pointed out in 1981, The bodies of the victims have been found piled up in ravines, dumped at roadsides, or buried in mass graves. Thousands bore the scars of torture, and death had come to most by strangling with a garrote, by being suffocated in rubber hoods, or by being shot in the head. The expectations of a propaganda model are fully realized in this case. Referring to our comparison of media treatment of 23 religious victims in Guatemala with the coverage accorded Popiahuisco, only 4 of the 23 were ever mentioned by name in our media sample, and the 23 taken together had approximately 1/20th of the space in the New York Times that the newspaper of record gave to Popiahuisco. In the case of the murder in Guatemala of the American priest Reverend Stanley Rother, the New York Times reported on August 5, 1981, in a tiny back-page article, that 3 men had been arrested for questioning in the shooting. What was the outcome of the arrests? Were the arrested persons tried? Readers of the Times will never know, and the Guatemalan government did not have to suffer the embarrassment and pressure of the press raising questions in this or any of the remaining 22 Guatemalan cases. Along with the minuscule attention to the murder of Guatemalan priests, the details of the killings were brief, and no sense of outrage was generated or sustained. The few lengthier articles never discussed the role of the 1954 coup and the long training and supply relationship of the United States to the Guatemalan police and army. Rather, they almost invariably put the killings in the format of a civil war with unexplained atrocities of extremists of the right and left. An AP dispatch in the New York Times of May 16, 1981 is entitled, 4 Guatemalans Slain in Leftist-Rightist Rivalry. The article, which reports on the murder of one of our 23 priests, the Reverend Carlos Galvez Galindo, says the attacks appeared to be related to the long struggle for power between leftists and rightists. A UPI dispatch in the Times of July 29, 1981, reporting on the murder of Reverend Stanley Rother, also relates the attack to right-wing extremists, not the Guatemalan government. Time has Rother and his Guatemalan villagers caught in the middle of an undeclared civil war. Time never explains the roots of the civil war, nor the crucial role of the United States in refusing to allow peaceful social change and installing the institutions of permanent counter-revolution. Time does, in most unusual fashion, point out that the government was responsible for the overwhelming majority of the killings, and even more exceptionally, it cites Amnesty International's evidence that the paramilitary death squads are an arm of the government. But the article fails to give illustrations of the scope and quality of the murders and retreats, as noted, to the Civil War rationale. Even more compromising is its framing of the U.S. policy debate. According to Time, yet Guatemala confronts the Reagan administration with one of its toughest foreign policy challenges. On one hand, the country is viewed as a victim of Cuban-sponsored insurgency, needing U.S. support. On the other, the government obviously violates human rights. The dichotomy offered by Time is a bit uneven. The Cuban sponsorship is a Cold War ploy for which no evidence has ever been given, but it provides a convenient propaganda framework that is regularly deployed by the State Department to divert attention from its support of mass murderers. Time thus elevates it to equality with the real and extremely serious charge, and without an honest citation even to a political hack. The "on the other hand" is, despite the obviously, a gross understatement. The Reagan administration chose to support and provide regular apologetics for a genocidal government that was using a policy of massacre to destroy a purely indigenous revolt. The challenge for the Reagan administration, quite different from that portrayed by Time, was how to sell the support of mass murder. Time did its little bit by unqualified transmission of the claim of a Cuban-based insurgency, which posed a serious dilemma for policymaking. The Holocaust years, 1978-85, yielded a steady stream of documents by human rights groups that provided dramatic evidence of a state terrorism in Guatemala approaching genocidal levels. Many of these documents had a huge potential for educating and arousing the public, but as a propaganda model would anticipate, they were treated in our media sample in a manner that minimized their informational value and capacity to create and mobilize public indignation. using a selection of 10 important reports on Guatemala by Amnesty International and America's Watch, issued in the years 1981 through 87, we could only find mention of four of them in our media sample. None of these four made it to the first page, and none provided the basis for an editorial or the building up of a press campaign of sustained coverage and indignation. The spectacular AI report of 1981 on disappearances, a workbook describing a frightening development of state terrorism in the Nazi mold, was entirely ignored by our media sample, as was AI's March 1985 report on disappearances under the government of General Oscar Humberto Mejia Victoris, which, if publicized, would have interfered with the media's portrayal of the Guatemalan elections of 1984-85 as exercises in legitimation, as described in the next chapter. AW's 1985 report on the Mutual Support Group was ignored, as was the 1987 study of human rights in Guatemala during Cerezo's first year. We return to the Mutual Support Group in the next section. We will see in the next chapter, too, that the media reported Cerezo's election in a framework of hopefulness and optimism, despite prior electoral experience in Guatemala and Cerezo's own expressed doubts about his ability to rule. The ignoring of AW's retrospective describing the actual results of Cerezo's presidency reflects the media's general failure to follow up on the effects of client state elections, as we show in Chapter 3 with regard to El Salvador. We described earlier the important America's Watch study, Guatemala Revised, How the Reagan Administration Finds Improvements in Human Rights in Guatemala, whose most striking and important theme was the ex post facto admission by the State Department that its apologetics for the previous general had been false. This illuminating document was ignored in our media sample, except for the New York Times, which gave it a 3-inch article on page 7 under the benign title, Rights Group Faults U.S. on Guatemala Situation, September 24, 1985. The article describes the report as saying that the administration has refused to acknowledge major human rights abuses in Guatemala, but it fails to mention the stress on the ex post facto tacit admission of lying. Mentioning this would, of course, suggest that the Times' primary source for its news is thoroughly untrustworthy. The last paragraph of the article, which absorbs a quarter of the 3 inches devoted to this document, gives a State Department response to the AW report, which is that AW is less a human rights organization than it is a political one. The brazen hypocrisy of this retort would have been clear and dramatic if the article had given the gist of AW's evidence that the administration was not merely an apologist for state terrorism in Guatemala, but was also demonstrably dishonest. In its concern to protect the Guatemalan generals in their terroristic assault on the population, the Reagan administration took umbrage at organizations like Amnesty International and America's Watch and mounted a systematic campaign in 1981 and 1982 to discredit them as left-wing and politically biased. In a letter dated September 15, 1982, directed to AI and the Washington Office on Latin America, Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Enders assailed the reporting of these organizations as one-sided and apologetic for the ferocious and terrorist attacks of the guerrillas. Enders writes that no one would deny the possibility of units of the military in contravention of stated policy having been involved in violations of human rights. What is important is that since March 23rd, the government of Guatemala has committed itself to a new course and has made significant progress. This amazing piece of apologetics for an army that was in the midst of slaughtering thousands of civilians was distributed within Guatemala as an official U.S. document, and its full text appeared in the Guatemalan press. AW states, "We find this use of the letter unconscionable in light of the risks run by human rights investigators in a political climate like Guatemala's. It also appears to us to be further evidence that the State Department, like the Guatemalan government, admits no neutrals in the Guatemalan conflict. The bringer of bad news becomes, through this reasoning, part of the enemy to be publicly discredited if possible." America's Watch also indicated that the State Department's substantive criticisms of AW and AI were not merely incompetent, but, more important, were based largely on the assumed truthfulness of Guatemalan army claims, a form of gullibility displayed clearly in the statement by Enders quoted previously. As we discussed in Chapter 1, the government is a primary flak producer as well as information source. This Guatemala episode is an important illustration of the government's efforts to silence competing sources of information. It is interesting that the New York Times never mentioned or criticized this sinister campaign, even though it was carried out in the context of a policy protecting mass murderers. We will see in the next chapter that Time magazine cooperated with the campaign, citing America's Watch only once on Guatemala, but with the qualifying explanation that it is a controversial group that is often accused of being too sympathetic to the left. The State Department, on which Time relies very heavily, is never subject to any adjectives suggesting any bias. The Washington Post, December 4, 1982, had one back-page article by Terry Shaw on the Enders letter, which features the State Department charges in the title, Embassy Sees Disinformation on Guatemala, U.S. Report Says Rights Groups Are Used, and in the text. The author allows the embassy claim that the report never was meant to be made public to stand unchallenged and never refers to the threat posed to human rights monitors by the release of such State Department charges. The human rights groups are allowed to suggest a State Department intent to discredit, but the word disinformation is never applied to State Department allegations, and no serious examination of the content of those charges is provided. This superficial piece exhausts the sample media's coverage of this State Department campaign. The AW report, Human Rights in Guatemala, No Neutrals Allowed, which discusses this campaign and the Enders letter, was never mentioned. 2.6. The Mutual Support Group Murders in Guatemala. Human rights monitoring and protective agencies have had a very difficult time organizing and surviving in the death squad democracies of El Salvador and Guatemala. Between October 1980 and March 1983, five officials of the Human Rights Commission of El Salvador were seized and murdered by the security forces. In accord with the propaganda model, these murders should have been of little interest to the U.S. mass media, and this expectation is borne out by evidence. As an illustrative comparison, the New York Times had a grand total of four back-page articles on these five murders, whereas during the same period, the Times had 35 articles on the Soviet human rights activist Natan Sharansky, not all of them on the back pages. The proportionality of attention fits well our general propaganda model analysis of the media's treatment of worthy and unworthy victims. Guatemala has been even more inhospitable to human rights organizations than El Salvador. Guatemalan Archbishop Monsignor Prospero Peinados del Barrio asserted in 1984 that it is impossible for a human rights office to exist in Guatemala at the present time. Disappearances as an institutional form began in Guatemala in the mid-1960s and eventually reached levels unique in the Western Hemisphere, with the total estimated to be some 40,000. Protest groups that have formed to seek information and legal redress have been consistently driven out of business by state-organized murder. The Association of University Students, AEU, sought information on the disappeared through the courts in the course of a brief opening in 1966, but after one sensational exposé of the police murder of 28 leftists, the system closed down again. As McClintock points out, in the next few years, many AEU leaders and member law students were hunted down and killed. In the 1970s, a committee of the relatives of the disappeared was organized by the AEU with headquarters in San Carlos National University. As America's Watch points out, it disbanded after plainclothesmen walked into the university's legal aid center on March 10, 1974, and shot and killed its principal organizer, lawyer Edmundo Guerra Telheimer, the center's director. Another human rights group, the National Commission for Human Rights, was created in the late 1970s by psychologist and journalist Irma Flacker. Her son was murdered and she herself disappeared on October 16, 1980. According to the British Parliamentary Human Rights Group, in 1984 alone, there were an average of 100 political murders and over 40 disappearances per month in Guatemala. These figures are almost surely an underestimate, as only the disappearances that took place in and around Guatemala City received any publicity. The greater number of murders and disappearances occur among rural and Indian families who do not have the resources to complain and are more exposed to retaliation. In this context of murder, fear, and the prior failure of all human rights organizations, the Mutual Support Group, or GAM, was formed in June 1984. It was a product of the desperation felt by people seeking information on the whereabouts of disappeared relatives and willing to take serious risks to that end. Many of them had suffered enormous pain in frustrating searches and inquiries that never bore fruit. There is no legal redress in Guatemala, and nothing useful can be obtained by appeals to the police or courts of law. Mr. Hicho, looking for his disappeared daughter, saw some 100 bodies in the months he spent at the morgue, and 70 to 75% of them had been tortured. Others took different painful routes in their search. In early 1985, one woman was told by an army officer that her husband was still alive and that he would see to his return if she slept with him. She did so, and her husband turned up dead shortly thereafter. The intention of the organizers of GAM was to seek strength by collective action and to use it to gather data and seek redress by petition and publicity. Their hope for survival and success rested in part on the fact that the chief of state, Mejia Victores, was being built up by the Reagan administration as another reformer, and the Reagan-Mejia Victores team was trying to establish the appropriate image to induce Congress to loosen the purse strings. GAM also had support within Guatemala from Archbishop Peinados del Barrio and other church groups and laypersons, although few felt able to speak up in the system of unconstrained state terror. Internationally, GAM received significant political support from progressive and humanitarian political parties and human rights groups. 30 members of the newly organized GAM held a press conference in Guatemala City in June 1984, denouncing the disappearances and calling on the government to intervene immediately in order to find our loved ones. In the latter part of June, and again in early August, masses were held in the Metropolitan Cathedral to express concern over the fate of the disappeared, with the initial services held by the university rector Mayer Maldonado and Archbishop Peinados. 1,000 people attended the August Mass. On August 1st, the group first met with General Mejia Victores, at which time he promised to investigate the disappearances. In ads placed in the major newspapers on August 8th and 9th, GAM put his promises on the public record. Subsequently, the group began to call attention to the government's failure to follow through on the August 1st promises, and they moved gradually to other actions. In October 1984, they sponsored a march and mass for the disappeared at the cathedral, the first mass demonstration in Guatemala since May 1, 1980, at which time protesters were seized on the streets and an estimated 100 were assassinated or disappeared. The organization continued to grow, from the initial handful to 225 families in November 1984, and then to 1,300 in the spring of 1986. Most of the members were women, a large majority peasant women from the countryside. They were persistent. After initial petitions, requests, meetings, and marches, they began to make explicit accusations and publicly charge elements of the National Security Forces as directly responsible for the capture and subsequent disappearance of our family members. They asked for an investigation, an accounting, and justice. They appealed to the Constituent Assembly and began regular protests in downtown Guatemala City, banging pots and pans and, on occasion, peacefully occupying buildings. Nothing, of course, was done in response to the GAM demands. The Assembly had no powers anyway, but was too fearful even to pass a resolution of support. The military rulers toyed with GAM. In public, with the press on hand, Mejia Victores would say, "I don't want to shirk responsibilities, and something has to be done." But when the press was not there, he said, "It seems as though you are accusing me, and we don't have them," the disappeared. "You have them," we said. "We don't have them," he replied. The military rulers were getting annoyed, and phone threats, letters of warning, and open surveillance intensified. 2 days after the exchange between Mejia Victores and GAM, the tortured bodies of two disappeared associated with GAM members showed up, one placed in front of his house with his eyes gouged out and his face barely recognizable. In a television interview on March 14, 1985, Meja Victoris said that GAM was being used by subversion because if they have problems, solutions are being found, and they have been given every advantage to solve these problems. A spate of newspaper headlines followed, stressing government warnings and allegations that GAM was being manipulated by subversives. In mid-March, General Meja Victoris was asked on television what action the government would take against GAM. He replied, "You will know it when you see it." On March 30, 1985, GAM leader Hector Gomez Calito was seized, tortured, and murdered. The six policemen who had come for him were themselves assassinated shortly after his death. He had been burned with a blowtorch on the stomach and elsewhere, and beaten on the face so severely that his lips were swollen and his teeth were broken. His tongue had been cut out. Then on April 4th, another leader of GAM, Maria Rosario Godoy de Cuevas, her 21-year-old brother, and her 2-year-old son were picked up, tortured, and murdered. Her breasts had bite marks, and her underclothing was bloody. Her 2-year-old son had had his fingernails pulled out. On grounds of newsworthiness, the murders of the two GAM leaders, along with the brother and the child of one of them, would seem to deserve high-order attention. Their bravery was exceptional. The villainy they were opposing was extraordinary. The justice of their cause was unassailable, and the crimes they suffered were more savage than those undergone by Popiewuszko. Most important of all, these were crimes for which we bear considerable responsibility, since they were perpetrated by clients who depend on our support, so that exposure and pressure could have a significant effect on safeguarding human rights. On the other hand, the Reagan administration was busily trying to enter into warmer and more supportive relations with the Guatemalan military regime and, as we described earlier, was going to great pains to put the regime in a favorable light. A propaganda model would anticipate that even these dramatic and horrifying murders would be treated in a low-key manner and quickly dropped by the mass media, that, unlike Popiewuszko, there would be no sustained interest, no indignation capable of rousing the public and disturbing the administration's plans. These expectations are fully vindicated by the record. Compare the media coverage of the Popiewuszko case with that of the murders of the GAM leaders. It is immediately obvious that the treatment is radically different in the two cases. The GAM murders couldn't even make the news at Time, Newsweek, or CBS News. The New York Times never found these murders worthy of the front page or editorial comment, and we can see that the intensity of its coverage was slight. The first report of the quadruple murder was on April 7, 1985, in a tiny item on page 5 of the paper, in which it is mentioned that the body of Maria Rosario Godoy de Cuevas was found in her car in a ravine, along with the bodies of her brother and her young son. In neither this item nor any succeeding article does the Times provide details on the condition of the bodies, or mention that the 2-year-old child had his fingernails torn out. In other respects, too, the Times article, all written by Stephen Kinzer, generally employ an apologetic framework. That is, they don't focus on the murders, who the victims were, the details of the violence, who did it, why, and the institutional structures and roots of organized murder of which these are an obvious part. With Popiewuszko, these were the issues. Kinzer has little or nothing on the details of the GAM murders and very little on the victims and the experiences that brought them to GAM and the question of who did it and what was being done, or not done, to bring the murders to justice he hardly considers. Kinzer takes it for granted that the murders were committed by agents of the state, but he doesn't say this explicitly or discuss the background or provide a framework for evaluating the case. He looks objectively at the scene, quoting some of the GAM survivors in brief and rhetorical statements that are offset by quotes from the generals. They approved the formation of GAM, an ambitious half-truth. They appointed an investigating committee that found no evidence of secret detention centers in Guatemala. No mention of the composition of the committee, no counter-evidence, and no mention of issues they may have overlooked. like disappeared, who were murdered. And they deny any responsibility for the murder of Godoy, her brother, and her son, who they claim to have been victims of an auto accident. If Kinzer had given the details of the victim's injuries, this lie would have been exposed as such, and further questions would have suggested themselves. In article after article, Kinzer repeats that the Mejia Victoris government has pledged to return to civilian rule shortly, which helps deflect attention from the ongoing killing and its causes, and from the GAM murders under discussion. He also does not tell us what civilian rule would mean in a terrorist state in which, as he knows, the effective rulers would be the same military forces. In the Popiełuszko case, once it was established that the police had committed the murder, the media spent a great deal of space discussing the police apparatus and police methods, as well as attending to the responsibility of the people at higher levels for the murder. Kinzer doesn't discuss these questions at all. The structure of the Guatemalan murder machine and how it works would make a good story, and numerous details of its operation were available. But this did not fit the government agenda and the Times format. Similarly, the role of Mejia Victoris in the murder of the GAM leaders, recall his warnings just prior to the murders, and consider his virtually unlimited discretionary power to murder or protect the citizenry, is ignored. But, once again, the links to the top in the case of unworthy victims do not fit the propaganda format. Kinzer does a nice job of making the GAM murders seem to be part of the natural background.